So just tell me if I'm not speaking loud enough, because apparently I have a quiet voice. First off, yeah, louder already. I wanted to say thank you to Brian and to Guy for having me here today. I came to the conference last year that was in Cambridge, and I have to admit that I think many of you probably felt the same when you first came here. It's a certain amount of trepidation, you know. Speeches about speech writing, how's that going to go? And I'm happy to say that I completely underestimated the value of such speeches and of conferences like this, not least just for making me feel kind of magically less alone, because I now feel like I'm part of some kind of weird brotherhood or sisterhood. So thank you. And today, what I wanted to share with you, my new brothers and sisters, is a few of my experiences in crisis communications, and in particular, a few of the lessons of speech writing for the President of the European Commission during the worst refugee crisis that the world has seen since the Second World War. And I am going to share with you three quick lessons that I have learned during this time. The first thing that the refugee crisis taught me is speech writing matters. And I think you've probably come to this revelation on your own already, but allow me to explain how I came to it. So the first thing you should know about me is that I come from a long line of people who have little to no interest in politics whatsoever. So my mum doesn't even vote, but the pride of the pack has got to be my sister. Because she's asked me to stop telling people that she once had to ask me who Angela Merkel was. So obviously I keep doing it a lot. And there was this one day on the 19th of April 2015 when my sister was visiting me. She lives in London. She was visiting me in Brussels. And it's a Sunday. It's a rarely sunny day in Brussels. And I've taken her out for brunch. And we're sitting on this, you know, sun-dappled terrace, sipping our lattes, and I get a phone call. And the phone call was to say that there was a boat with 700 souls on board that had sunk just off the coast of Lampedusa in Italy. And the president wanted to issue a statement regretting the loss of life. So I proceed to spend the next 4 to 6 hours drafting this statement, redrafting the statement, agonizing over whether or not to use the word chagrined, which I did in the end, worrying that if the president ever actually had to say it out loud, if he would be able to pronounce it, the answer is no. and then I have to get the statement validated by God knows how many layers of hierarchy, then by the president himself. Finally, I publish the statement. And then, because, as Guy said, I'm also the spokesperson, I then have to respond to all the journalists' questions about the statement. So this takes up pretty much the whole day. And my sister is sitting there and visibly frustrated with me at this point. And she says to me, "Okay, so what exactly have you achieved? You've published a statement, so what?" I think at this point I should explain that my sister is actually this kind of wonderful specimen of a human being. She is a pediatrician in palliative care at Great Ormond Street Hospital in London. And so her work has such this tangible, visible impact immediately on the people that she is she's helping. And her question to me comes from that. You know, she's saying, okay, you've got a few sentences that are now on the wires, with or without the term chagrined, or chagrined. And what is that going to do to change the fact that 700 people just lost their lives? Whatever you write, whatever the president says, that's not going to change that fundamental fact. And I'm trying to explain to her, you know, that this is an unprecedented statement. We've never used such strong language before, and it's completely unprecedented. And she's totally not buying it. And in the end, I thought about it a lot, and in the end it took me 3 months before I could go back to her, buy her another brunch, and explain the value of that particular statement. Explain that it started, yes, with just a few words, but the next day it was a 10-point plan for immediate action in the Mediterranean. The day after that, it was the conclusions of an emergency meeting of foreign and interior ministers. And the day after that, it was the conclusions of a European Council of heads of state and a government of the entire European Union. And those conclusions became an amendment to the budget. And that amendment to the budget tripled the amount of resources that the EU dedicates to search and rescue in the Mediterranean. And what that meant was that within 3 months, we had three times as many boats physically in the water saving lives. Fast forward 4 years later, we now have four such maritime operations at sea that have helped save over 730,000 lives in the Mediterranean. So yes, it matters. What we say matters, and words may not have the same immediacy as a medical procedure, but it doesn't mean that they can't change lives or even save them. And this statement, it was a declaration of intent. It was a commitment from the president of the European Commission. And this is how I see speeches. They're an opportunity to present a different world, not the world as it is, but the world as it could be. It's a chance to open eyes, it's a chance to open hearts, and maybe, just maybe, change the world and make it that little bit better. And so the privilege of being, you know, part of that process, I think, is something that I've never underestimated since. And I like to use this example on those, you know, I like to think of this example of, on the kind of dark days that I think we've all faced. For me, it's often when writing the opening remarks of the Economic and Social Committee meeting, but to remind myself that, you know, our choice of words does matter. And writing particularly about the refugee crisis has taught me not just that our words matter, but every single one of them matters. Because at the start of the crisis, that, you know, sunny and tragic day in April 2015, at the time the overwhelming public response to the refugee crisis was one of sympathy. But as time drew on, that sympathy dissipated, and more often than not, it was replaced with fear. And what ensued has been a series of policy clashes, which have manifested themselves most visibly in a war of words. And whilst I think I'm contractually obliged to argue that the EU's response to the refugee crisis has been comprehensive, I think it's no secret that there are some areas where we've just failed to achieve agreement on common action. And I believe that this is partly the consequence of some of the political communication of the various actors involved in addressing the refugee crisis. And there was this literature professor in the 60s called Victor Klemperer, who was obsessed with the idea of what happened to language when it became the bearer of poisons. And so he was looking into the Third Reich and how the German language was twisted to serve the purposes of the Nazi regime at the time. And there's this quote that really struck me. Words can be like tiny doses of arsenic. They are swallowed unnoticed, appear to have no effect, and then after a little time, the toxic reaction sets in after all. And for me, I think this is to some extent what has been happening with the discourse on migration at the moment. And to take an example, the seemingly innocent term frontline member states. I mean, what it's referring to is EU member states at the external borders of the European Union. But it's using war terminology, frontline. You're on the front line of a battle. And the question is, you know, who are we at war with? And the same goes for the term illegal migrant. Our migration laws have long spoken about illegal border crossings, meaning that, you know, the act of crossing a border without permission to do so is illegal. But if you shift that terminology just slightly, you just cut out the middleman and talk about illegal migrants, what you're effectively saying is that the individual, as opposed to any act that they have committed, is illegal, and that a person's existence is in and of itself criminal. And there are unfortunately many examples of this ilk that I could give you. And as some of them were immediately met with public backlash. And I'm thinking of the term swarm used by David Cameron. Please don't take offence, Jess. I'm sure it wasn't, I can't imagine for the second that it was scripted, and surely my boss is hardly an example to go by on unscripted remarks. he keeps talking this week about the House of Commons being a sphinx that's like a book that needs to talk, and I have no idea what he means. So even if this term, you know, that swarm was met with this this public backlash, for the most part, these subtle shifts in language have gone completely unnoticed. Terms like illegal migrants, burden sharing, waves of arrivals, you know, they now litter council conclusions and speeches given by all of our leaders. And they even pop up in commission policy documents when I don't get to them in time. But I don't think that we should underestimate the role that this has played in turning the debate about migration in the European Union into something really and incredibly divisive, because these words are sowing discord. And policy positions now, they're so polarized that they've been reduced to, you know, either you want to let everyone in or you want to let no one in. And there is seemingly little room for a reasonable compromise somewhere in the middle. And so the lesson that I have drawn from this whilst writing for the president on the topic of migration in particular is that I have become hyper-vigilant about every single word that I use. Because just as one statement can have a kind of transcendent effect on policymaking down the line, I also think that one word can fundamentally change our very perception of an issue, and sometimes without us even noticing. So on that joyous note, that what that means is that, you know, a lot of the writing that I've done on the refugee crisis has been about trying to inject this massive dose of pathos to counter the proliferation of dehumanizing terms and rhetoric that makes us forget that what we're talking about at the end of the day are people. So sentences like this one: imagine for a second it were you, your child in your arms, the world you knew torn apart around you. There is no price you would not pay, there is no wall you would not climb, no sea you would not sail, no border you would not cross if it was war or the barbarism of the Islamic State that you are fleeing. Copyright Juncker 2015. And pathos works. We all know that pathos works. But I don't think that it's enough. And this is the final lesson that I wanted to share with you today, is that in crisis communications, and particularly on such, you know, emotionally charged subjects as the refugee crisis, it's all about authenticity. Because the only way an organization, a leader, or a presidency can survive a crisis, particularly if they're not able to, you know, spontaneously and magically whip up a solution to that crisis, is if they come across as authentic. Because landmark speeches, I think, they're never the ones that you think they're going to be. They're never the ones that you spend months agonizing over. They're never the State of the Union. they're often the ones that that you least expect, that become the ones that resonate through time, because they're the ones where the speaker has come across as most authentic. And I think this is the same point that Malika was making, but she just made it more eloquently. but it's when speakers are authentic that the audience is kind of blown away. And so for me, writing for Juncker, it was always less about finding an emotional connection with the audience or worrying about, you know, what's going to resonate with them. I was always worrying about what resonates with the president. And because if he, you know, he has that emotional connection to the material, then the effect is immediately contagious. And it's also because one of the things you should know about President Juncker is that 99% of the time he does not read his speeches. So the one exception is the State of the Union. That's the only one that he will read word for word. But other than that, for everything else, he typically, you know, comes up to me just before he's about to go on the podium, beautifully crafted speech in hand, and he says, "Excellent speech, Natasha. Really good. Thanks." And then he does this classic move where he folds it in two, slides it into the inner jacket of his pocket, and then delivers an entirely different speech altogether. But I still have a job, because maybe not that day, and maybe not in the speech that he delivers the next day, But maybe in the speech that he gives a week later or, you know, a month later, suddenly, out of nowhere, he will recite word for word the, you know, extract, the anecdote, the figure, whatever that I put in that undelivered speech. Because that's the bit that resonated with him. That's the thing that stuck in his mind. And Juncker has been in politics for 35 years. His narrative on Europe and everything to do with Europe is fully constructed. And I think, you know, there's few people left in this world that can speak about Europe with more authority than he can. So me, you know, quite a bit his junior, writing for him, the best that I can do is not try and give him a new narrative. I can give him new elements that fit the narrative he already has in his mind, and in some cases, you know, revitalize it. And Europe for Juncker is a love story. And the language that he naturally employs when he's talking about Europe is one of love. In fact, it's so flowery at times that, you know, the inner Brit cringes. But this is a man just with like a great deal of heart, and nowhere more so than when it comes to Europe. And you'd think that, you know, when coming back to the refugee crisis, that you're talking about migration, which is an emotional topic, that would just come naturally, and that you could just tap into that well of love. But actually, I think the contrary is true, because often, and particularly I think for the president, the emotion that, you know, immediately comes to the fore when you're thinking about migration is actually one of anger. You know, it's outrage that these people have lost these lives. It's anger that there's so much pain and suffering and, you know, frustration that we weren't able to stop it, or that, you know, we haven't, the solutions to these problems are not as forthcoming as we would like them to be, often because of the member states. But, you know. So during the refugee crisis, the way that I found of allowing the president to be, you know, more authentic and to come across as authentic was by giving him material that unlocked that, you know, deep and mushy self inside him. And there's one story that I found about a Greek baker on the island of Kos in the Aegean. And when, at the height of the refugee crisis, October 2015, you had 10,000 people a day arriving on the Aegean islands, and particularly in Kos. And there's this guy, this baker, who starts giving away 100 kilos of bread from his bakery to refugees. And at the time, it was a local story in local newspapers in Greece, and there were, in fact, much bigger, kind of similar stories in the Greek press. There was some woman who rescued a Syrian refugee on her speedboat, and that was the big story. But there was this little, you know, local newspaper that was writing about it, and I only knew about it because I had a Greek boyfriend at the time who'd shown me this story, and like all good speechwriters, I was like, perfect, I will exploit that. So I wrote the president this sentence: Europe is the baker in Kos who gives away his bread to hungry and weary souls. This is the Europe I want to live in. And that was it. I mean, it was really short. But this baker became this hugely iconic figure. And I was actually fortunate enough to meet him later on in a later visit to the island of Kos. And I was unfortunate enough to write a letter of condolences on behalf of the president to his family when he passed away earlier this year. But this one sentence in the speech was actually next to a lot of other examples. There was also, I mentioned the pensioners in Calais that had set up an electrical outlet so that migrants passing through could charge their phones, or the students in Saigon in Germany that were greeting refugees with clothes and food at the railway. But this is the baker in Kos, that's the one that stuck. And that is the one that, when he used it again in his State of the Union speech that year, it became the most quoted soundbite of a 40-minute long speech, and it would made headlines across all newspapers. And I am convinced that the reason is because it was the moment that the president spoke most authentically, most naturally, because it was a story that reminded him of why he loves Europe so much, and he was able to make other people feel that love. So yeah, these are the three takeaways that I have from communicating in crisis, and particularly the refugee crisis. Speeches matter, in case you didn't know. Every word matters, and making sure that your speaker can speak with authenticity on them matters above all. And of course, love is all you need.